construction and design versus U.S. Ms. Goodlow.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Laura Goodlow, and I'm here on behalf of plaintiff appellants.
Speak louder, please. I can't hear you.
I'm here on behalf of plaintiff appellants construction and design company. Is that better?
A little.
We're here today on an immigration issue, particularly some visa petition denials. As typically would happen, this began at an administrative level. We appealed to the Administrative Appeals Unit.
Let me ask you this. I'm sympathetic to your argument that the government shouldn't use net income as a basis for deciding whether you can afford to pay these people. But what is it that you presented what is there in the record, actually? There's your balance sheet and income statement and tax returns. Is that what's in the record?
With regard to the AAO evidence that we submitted to support the ability that the employer could pay the proffered wage, we had IRS forms 1120S, which are the corporate tax returns for 2000-2002.
You have to speak louder and slower. I can't hear you.
I apologize. We also had a translation from the employee's bank records back in the Ukraine. We had copies of the petitioner's status reports from the Ukraine, and it essentially was a registered transaction for the employee.
No, I'm not. The only thing I'm interested in is what documents are there in the record that cast light on the financial situation of your client?
I would argue that would be the gross income.
No. I'm asking what documents, not what they show. What documents? What's the basis of the gross income figure? Is that your accountant's audit or what? Your balance sheet?
I would assume that the basis of the gross income is
what... Well, don't you know what's in the record? What is in the record about the financial situation of the company?
I thought that came from... Is that from the tax returns?
That's what I was assuming, that the gross return.
Is that all? There's a tax return? Is that it? As far as the documentary basis?
We didn't have any, if you're asking for, like, audited financial statements or something of that sort. We didn't have any audited financial statements or other documents that were allowable under 204.5G2, if that's...
What do you mean allowable? Why wouldn't...
Well, like, you could have, in addition to the tax returns, you could have financial statements that were audited that went towards the notion of how much a company grossed at that period of time.
Couldn't you just have a balance sheet? Is it that the government has prescribed specific or limited the ways in which you can show financial capability of paying people?
Yes and no. There are limits in terms of what documents you're allowed to submit, as well as what documents will be considered at the administrative appeal level.
What are the limits?
Well, under 204.5G2, it's the regulation states that the ability to pay the wage offered must be shown at the priority date once it's established and continuing, and the evidence shall be either in the forms of copies of annual reports, federal tax returns, or audited financial statements.
So we essentially... That's page 13, right, of your brief.
Yes, ma'am. Yes.
So your company doesn't have an annual report, is that?
In this case,
you didn't submit it.
It was not submitted,
You don't have an auditor? A company doesn't have an auditor?
I do not know the answer to that question, Your Honor. However, I think that the basis...
This is a small company, right?
It's a smaller company. One employer has 3 employees. The other has about 12.
Well, that's about $500,000 a year, doesn't it?
Yes.
In revenue. Now, that's revenue, right?
Yes.
And this netting, so all that's in the record is the tax return as far as bearing on the finance of the company, is that correct? Just the tax return. So This net income figure that the government is fascinated with, is that that's pre-tax, isn't it? Or after tax?
The net income is essentially what is...
Not essentially. What is it?
The net income
comes off the tax return,
is what comes off of the gross. It's all the deductions that are made. It's all the deductions and the accountings that are made.
So is it net taxable income or net income after federal income tax?
It's net income after... It's net taxable income. I apologize.
It's what?
Net taxable income.
Right. So it's pre-tax.
Yes.
It's the taxable pre-tax income. Okay.
Which is why I thought you were saying that if people are taking large deductions, then they might be following a tax minimization strategy.
That's exactly what they're doing. So maybe I just recently misspoke, but again, I apologize. I'm not an expert in taxes.
Okay. The only, if you look at the deductions, so you have salaries and rent, and so they're kind of small depreciation. The biggest is $155,466 for outside services. Do we have any idea what that is?
I believe with the one employer, he was hiring outside contractors to do the work, and one of the arguments at the administrative level was that they did not take into consideration that he would no longer be using that outside work, as he no longer have to pay for that outside work once his employee's visa petition had been approved. But
the regulation apparently says you have to approve this with your tax returns if you don't have the annual report and the audit report. But from what you're saying, apparently testimony is permitted. So you put in the tax return, but then there's an evidentiary hearing to go over the items in the tax return and explain, what they mean and so on.
Essentially, there's an interview. You're in front of a hearing officer to go through the petition that's been filed, as well as the tax returns and any supporting documentation. And then what happens is if they do not find that there's sufficient evidence to approve the visa petition at that time, you are given what's called a request for additional evidence. They can request additional financial documents, and I believe both cases they did. We attempted to supply them with additional financial documents to establish the, the proffered wage would be paid to these employees. However, from that point on, it went downhill. And
I don't understand you. So they asked for additional evidence, and you what? Now it's presented in documents or testimony or what?
It was presented in documents. Once the request.
This was the asset evidence?
Yes. You submit documents back to the BCIS, and they determine whether it's sufficient.
First, you said the only admissible documents were tax returns, audited financial statements, and annual reports. Now you're saying that you were given a chance to submit additional documents?
The way this system is set up is that there's deference given to the agency. The agency has the deference to ask for additional documents and also look outside the...
Okay, so they let you submit additional documents. So you submitted, a balance sheet showing assets and liabilities?
We submitted several pieces of evidence for both Posatsky as well as Olszlansky. And again, neither of them were sufficient to establish...
I'm just interested in the financial situation of the company.
Again, in terms of the company's gross income, the only...
We know about that, but the balance sheet, you say there's a statement of assets and liabilities.
There was deeds of ownership to three distinct properties. There was a breakdown of
and what's the
beneficiaries,
what form
1099.
Was that submitted in? Is that an affidavit or is that a...
They were just the copies of the deeds submitted back to BCIS.
Well, where does the total asset figure come from?
The total asset figure, I would assume, would come from the gross income on the tax returns.
Income and assets are completely different.
Pardon?
Income and assets are completely different.
It's my understanding, and I apologize if I'm confusing this court, it's my understanding that you submit the tax returns, and they essentially look at net income as a basis. Then if they needed additional evidence...
No, and then you had a chance to show what the assets and liabilities of the company were. Now, what form was that presented to?
It was essentially a request for evidence that we replied or responded to.
Is it a balance sheet or is it?
Again, there were several pieces of evidence. There was deeds. There was 1099s.
There has to be there's a figure in here that the government cites for the total assets minus liabilities. Now, where is what form? How is that calculated? Companies submit a statement showing assets and liabilities. It's called a balance sheet, or what?
How did they arrive at the government, that is, that there was only an asset of $11,000? What kind of math?
The government looked at net current assets from 2001 and 2002.
And that was based on the deeds?
That was just based on whatever was in those tax returns.
But the deeds aren't in the tax returns.
Okay, but the deeds, I apologize. The deeds were the additional evidence they requested later. But in terms of the tax returns, what typically happens...
Do the tax returns list assets and liabilities or just income and deductions?
They list income and deductions.
And an individual tax return, you don't list your assets, just list your income.
I believe that they still do list the assets and liabilities because that's what goes from gross to net.
No, it doesn't.
No, that's an income
that's
number.
That's complete confusion.
It sounds like you gave the government raw data, like here's a deed to this property, and allowed the government then to deduce assets are things like a piece of land or stock or something that you have. It might be income generating, it might not be income generating. It's kind of a thing, if you will. It's got positive value. So normally you would have at least like a cover letter saying, here is the evidence of our assets or something like that. And we owe a mortgage on this property, so there's a liability that offsets or something.
And again, from my understanding of what went on prior to me starting this case was that it was a cover letter sent to the AAO with an entire list of what their additional evidence was going to be. And I'm trying to read off exactly what was considered by the AAO upon receipt of our response to the request for evidence. But in terms of the tax returns, that's,
Well, just what was on that list that you sent when you supplemented the...
Again, it was... We resent the tax returns for 2000 through 2003. We resent the beneficiary's employment record in Ukraine. We sent the government copies of petitioner status report. We sent deeds of ownership. We sent 1099s. Eight additional paychecks, and we also, I guess, going towards a different direction in the argument, these were the same sets of documents or the same evidence that had been previously submitted in other cases.
Yeah, I don't think that argument gets you anywhere.
Okay.
I mean, this is a notoriously incompetent government agency, so, of course, they're always making mistakes.
Well, with that, Your Honor, I'll let my esteemed colleague take the podium and hopefully respond adequately in rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you very, very much, Ms. Goodloe. Mr. Oswald, maybe you can answer this question. What evidence was actually before the agency the finances of this company?
Counsel. Your Honor, there are two different cases, and in the first case, which is the RG construction case involving Mr. Oslansky, there were corporate tax returns, and the first return that was submitted was incomplete. These are subchapter S corporations, so I'm not what I know of corporate law as a government lawyer, been for a long time, you could fit on a thimble.
Well, I'm not sure you should be arguing the case in that.
Well, I'm not sure in terms
in fact,
of...
The whole, well, go ahead.
Well, I'm not sure exactly what the tax consequences in terms of if it's before tax or after tax, Your Honor, but the concept is that they list these things, the assets are listed on that corporate tax return. So that's what they're coming up with. The net assets are defined as the net current assets minus the current liabilities, and that's all provided on their tax return. That was one case. In the second case, it was also subchapter S corporation, and in that case, they provided the same thing, which
so
is the corporate tax returns.
The assets and liabilities appear on the tax return. Okay. Is there any other evidence in the record bearing on the financial situation of the companies?
The second company, they submitted the corporate tax returns. And in both of these cases, Your Honor, you know, I understand your words about the notoriously incompetent agency, but they gave them a chance to come forward with additional information. And the regulation allows them to, doesn't limit anything. It says that they require the employers to demonstrate their ability to pay the proper wage through copies of annual reports, federal tax returns, or audited financial statements. That's the first part of the regulation. Then, in this case, in both of these companies' instances, the immigration authorities looked at this and said, you haven't proven your case. You haven't proven that you can pay these employees. So they asked them for additional information.
Right. So what did they provide?
And in this second case, they came back, they gave them an opportunity to do that. They came back again with the corporate tax returns. They came back with bank records from a bank that said, well, here's our bank and this is what our gross receipts are. They came up with the deeds of ownership that counsel talked about, which were deeds of ownership from the sole shareholder of the corporation.
But as you pointed out, it's a subchapter S corporation.
Right.
I guess
and then there were personnel records.
One of the things that worried me about this is a point that Ms. Goodlow referred to, is that net taxable income figure is the number you come to after you've taken appropriate deductions under the code. So if you deduct $50,000 that you paid to an outside contractor and come up with a number, and now next year you've hired an employee, and you're going to pay that employee $50,000. You're not going to presumably use the same number of outside contractors, so that really just shifts boxes inside the form, and it's quite possible that you don't end up with the same number. In fact, a rational corporation would be paying the outside contractor $55,000 and would realize that they could get the same job done by paying an employee $50,000, so they're actually a little better off. We don't have to get there, but the fact is this: there's a lot that goes on to come up with this number of net taxable income that conceals, I think, what the government's real interest is, which is, if we grant you this visa, are you really going to be employed in the way that both the Department of Labor has said you can be employed and the way the immigration statute permits, such that, you know, we are not just giving you some cover to blend into U.S. society?
I understand, Your Honor, and I agree with what Your Honor's saying, and I think that's what was done here. And this court,
I don't think it was done here at all.
Well,
that's my problem.
Your Honor, I respectfully point out to the second decision, which is on that very point that Your Honor is making on the independent contractor. They have $150,000 that is paid to independent contractors. They did absolutely nothing to show that this individual was taking the place. They just submitted, this is a person. We have him, and here's our statement. We're going to use this guy instead. And he's the same employee.
I thought they were using him as an independent contractor,
right, but
and that the 1099 showed that.
It didn't show that, and it's reflected in the decision, which is in the second appendix,
the last appendix here,
in terms of where they go into the fact that the individual, that they did nothing other than their statement, he's taking their place. There was nothing, Your Honor, that said, okay, here's what he's being paid.
How are they supposed to prove it beyond their statement?
Well, I would think that what they said was
something illegal.
He'll be replacing somebody, but we're going to be paying him $25,000 more than what he's making now. And when they looked at this,
replacing someone who charges more than $25,000 more, then they're saving money, right?
Right, but that was not documented within any of the information. Judge,
what do you mean documented?
In terms of, let's say that you came forward with an they cite three unreported cases, which counsel sent me because I couldn't find
cases.
But the concept, Your Honor, is that you come up with an affidavit from someone. Let's say you come up with an affidavit from the owner, and the owner would say,
"Let's make clear, because this net income stuff is irrational. So let me understand this. If they produced an affidavit which said, yes, we're paying this fellow more, but he's replacing an outside contractor who costs even more than this fellow, so we're going to be saving money, does that get them home free?
Yes.
Well, I wish that either the administrative opinion or your brief had recognized such a possibility, because it doesn't.
Well, their argument.
Because in your brief, you say that the only way that your brief suggests that you can, unless you're General Motors, unless that you can get outside the net income requirement, is to show that the company has hit a temporarily bad patch.
Right.
That's all you suggest. So I want to be very sure that it's the government's position that as long as they can show there's a net cost saving, they don't have to worry about net income and they don't have to worry about have they hit a bad patch.
Right.
Is that the government's position?
Yes. The first point that they start with in this analysis is this based upon what the evidence is presented. Is this person the added cost of this person that they can't see a savings? Is that paid for by their what they're making, net assets?
But that is ridiculous. Salaries out of net income.
But that starting point
is irrational.
But are they showing that? Then they go to this analysis of net income and net assets.
Maybe you need to
make
stay.
Any sense
yeah,
at
the
all.
First
that
stage
make any
because.
Sense.
Right, you're asking.
But the third step, Your Honor, is that matter of Sangawa case, which talks about unusual circumstances.
No, that's where you're all wet again, because that's Sangawa case, whatever it is. That's your example of the rough patch. Look, there's nothing unusual about hiring someone or buying some sort of input, the cost of which vastly exceeds your net income. But because you're replacing something that's even more expensive, you're better off.
I agree with that.
That's the only thing to look at.
And I'm not even...
You don't agree, because your brief has this net income nonsense, plus Sangawetta as the only exception. The administrative opinions don't recognize this. They don't say the question is, are your costs going to increase? And if they increase, are they going to eat up all your income? Because then if that happens, obviously that's suspicious.
Your Honor, one of the administrative opinions that's cited by counsel is a case involving an engineering firm that was not a large engineering firm. The district director initially denied the visa petition. It was then reviewed by the administrative appeals unit. The administrative appeals unit said, you look at these things in terms of you start, I understand, with the net income, and then you look to, did this company, for example, if it's operating at a deficit, did it take depreciation? Did it take bad debts? Did it write off bad debts? Did it depreciation? I'm not even saying that's unusual circumstances.
That's one of the cases
that they did, and they said.
Pointless. The only question, you're hung up on balance sheets and tax returns. The only question is this hiring going to increase the company's cost? That's the first question. If it increases the company cost, well, will it increase it enough to eat up their net income? And because if that's obviously a suspicious circumstance. You don't increase your costs in order to reduce your income. I mean, you can think of cases where you would, but you wouldn't normally do that.
Your Honor, I'm obviously failing here because you've just repeated what I've been trying to say.
No, because you start with a net income.
It's the amount.
The place to start is with the costs, and you compare the costs of the company, you know, before and after this new hiring.
I agree with that.
But that's not what you did in these cases, and it's not what the CIS says it's doing. It insists that it wants to look at net income. It's got this long line of cases that says net income is the place to look. You're making Chevron arguments that we ought to defer to the agency's choice of net income.
Your Honor, in my brief, such as it is, I go into the analysis, which is what Judge Dow did when he was at the district court. It was, what's the increased cost is the first step. Is that covered? Do they just obviously show that? And if not, is there some other way to explain that? And they did nothing. If they had come up with an affidavit that said, here's our cost savings, or we had this kind of depreciation that you're not looking at that, and this is kind of artificially deflating our numbers.
A little suspicious. I mean, suppose that they submitted an affidavit which said, yeah, so we want to pay these people this higher income, higher salary, and the reason we're doing it is that, you know, they're good workers and we hope to get more sales and we think we'll recoup the cost of their salary. Now, I don't think the agency would accept that.
I believe that they would have to. And if they ignored it, then I would agree that it's an abuse of discretion. The abuse of discretion here, Your Honor, is that what they're arguing is that you're going beyond gross receipts. My financial situation would be much better if you just looked at what I'm getting paid and my wife is getting paid. When we get into, you know, the problem we have is, you know, we're paying for 7 children and ourselves. And if I went to the bank and said, just look at my gross receipts without anything else, which is essentially what they're asking
the court to do. That's why Judge Posner said you have to look at costs. You know, to run a business, you have costs. And I just want to point out, on page 19 of your brief, you have a whole heading. It was rational for USCIS to assess the financial viability of the employers by analyzing net, which you've italicized, income. So, I mean, this is certainly an argument that you present to us.
Your Honor, I agree that that's where the analysis starts, but it doesn't end there. And that to me, I understand, and I'm not, you know, but I don't believe that you can just look at gross income. In banks, when you go for a loan, they don't just look at your gross income without your liabilities. If I went to a bank and said, you know, give me a loan, and they're essentially saying we should self-certify this. You should believe that we wouldn't spend this money.
What is the particular abuse against which this requirement is aimed? Is the concern that this is a racket, that this is a way of getting relatives or someone or co-ethnics or something into the United States, or what?
You, by the virtue of this, you're giving an individual a permanent residence, which is a green card, which is a direct path to citizenship that can be very valuable for some people. And in these cases, when you have small companies that where their viability is questioned, and one of these companies, Your Honor, was, you know, went out of business and then was taken over by somebody else in terms of a successor corporation, that's a real concern in terms of what the value of this is. That's why they look at this. And these individuals...
Answering my question, there must be some abuse, some concern that makes the government... So I understand how they want to make sure that this type of job, there aren't Americans who do it. That's the easiest.
Right.
That I understand. Why are they also concerned about the ability of the company that's hiring them to pay? What's that problem?
Because one, as you said, Your Honor, when you talked about, you said if you're paying more for this an individual to replace somebody, one might ask, why are you doing this?
Yes. And what's
in this case? If they're paying somebody who's already essentially these two individuals, whether they were independent contractors or not, in both cases, they were both working for much lower level pay than what they ended up coming up for. And so what happened was, in both of these cases, they're making $25,000. Two cases, it was $25,000 a year. The third case, it was $30,000.
What worries you about that?
Well, what is concerning about it is that this can be used by relatively small companies to, and I don't want to cast aspersions, but it's that there might be fraud involved, that these cases are done in terms of to confer permanent residence on somebody on the basis of filling a position like this, and then going under.
So the notion is some kind of racket in which, what, they're being paid on the...
Or that they can't support it, and that's what it's about.
Or what?
That they can't support these employees and that they are in this situation.
They can't support. So why?
And they give them a green card and then they're out of business.
Well, why would they do that? I don't understand. The companies bankrupt themselves to give somebody a green card? Why do they do that?
There are companies like this that perhaps are formed for the purpose of, which are small companies, one feeding the other, and then they go out of business, and they're not conferring that.
Did I hear you correctly? One feeding another?
Well, that one individual might form the company.
There's a couple of
others that work on a construction company.
Swarm, did you say?
Form a company. And then they file a visa petition on behalf of somebody after getting a labor certification, and then they go out of business.
They were taking in $500,000 a year. I mean, that's not... You think they just form this and they get $500,000 worth of business because they're trying to smuggle these people in?
I'm not trying to say that they're doing anything wrong. You're asking me, Your Honor, why they would be skeptical of this situation. And I think there is a...
Why are they skeptical of this situation?
Because I don't think that necessarily somebody should be able to confer a path to citizenship on somebody simply because when the law doesn't give that right, when they force them to meet requirements.
You seem to think this $500,000, this is both companies together. These are the same.
Well, they're different companies, Your Honor, but they're basically small construction companies.
It's the $500,000 is the combined...
I don't believe that's combined. I believe they're separate situations.
But that's just one of the little companies.
Right, and they've already had a worker approved for them.
Do you think that they form a company that has $500,000 in annual sales, and they've done it in order to get a green card for these guys, even though that will precipitate them into bankruptcy?
Judge, I don't think that is necessarily that they're doing anything wrong. What they're trying to do is to apply the law in terms of making people show that they pay the proper wage.
To survive in business?
I agree that they would be trying to survive in a business.
Don't they have a better idea of what they can afford than you do?
But, Judge, if their only evidence of this is gross receipts, and they say, take our word for it, why would we go out and hire an immigration lawyer and pay this money? If that's the only certification, that doesn't make any sense to me.
Answer is,
pardon?
I would be curious what your answer to that question is. Why would they go out, hire an immigration lawyer, want to pay these guys more? Why would they do that?
I believe that they're trying to operate a business, and they're trying to find somebody to fit that position. But I think that when you're a marginal employer, you have to do more than just submit your bank records. You have to be able to show, here's our cost savings, here's what we're trying to do in terms of making more money.
Represent that they were bringing in skilled workers that were not available in the United States?
These are certifications that are made that they're skilled workers that are not making in the United States. And I'm not trying to say that they're doing anything wrong. I'm merely trying to respond to the question of why somebody looks at this skeptically. And I believe that there are reasons why that they would look at it skeptically.
Is it the government's view that as the corporations get smaller, the skepticism should rise?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So a fraudulent scheme such as you suggest might occur, Mr. Oswald, couldn't occur with... a Fortune 500 company?
I think it would be less likely. It could occur, but I think it would be less likely.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Oswald. So, Ms. Goodlow, you have a couple of minutes. Yeah, 1 minute.
Thank you.
Ms. Goodlow, how do they find these workers? Is there anything in the record how they found these workers?
These employees?
Yes.
They, Mr. Ozlansky came from Poland. He's a woodworker. RG Construction had been seeking out a woodworker. I believe that there was a family member who tied him into that one. And I am not sure as to Mr. Posatsky's case, but I would assume it was a similar situation where there was a family friend who wanted to help out. What I think is happening here is counsel is essentially rehashing the current standard of review in terms of determining whether an employer can pay the ability or has the ability to pay the proffered wage. What we're requesting is that this standard changes. At the end of the day, it's our proposition that the employee or the employer is the one who's going to know best whether or not he can take on an additional employee. This process takes five times the amount of time it is to just go out and get a job on a normal basis, number one. Number two, the employer is going to be putting up a lot of money to sponsor this employee.
So you'd agree, though, you need to know more than just the gross income. You need to delve into the costs.
I actually do agree with that you should look at gross income as well as what Judge Posner had pointed out in saying that is employing this person going to up the costs to the extent that they won't be able to
manage. So what is the actual evidence of the impact of paying these guys on the cost structure of the companies?
Paying the individuals prior to having their visa petitions be?
No. The salary they're going to pay them if they get their visa petitions. What's the evidence as to how that will affect their business?
Well, we would presume that there would be an increase in productivity, which would...
Well, you can't presume that. You have to say something. I mean, is there some affidavit that says this is why we're hiring these people and, high salaries, but we think it's a good investment because they're productive workers, they're skilled, we have business, we have backlog, anything of that sort. Is there anything like that in the record?
Well, I do not know if there's anything of that in the record. I saw in the file that there was an affidavit, but I did not see it in the record.
So was there an affidavit saying at least that they would be replacing outside contractors?
It essentially asserted to the fact that this employer had so much money, was paying the employee so much money, and could continue to pay the employee so much money, and kind of gave a breakdown of how that money was coming in and going out, and how it was speculated, I don't like to say the word, but it was speculated that given upon hiring him, the productivity level of the corporation would increase.
There are affidavits of that sort?
I saw an affidavit this morning. I can't...
We'll have to look. Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Goodlow. Thank you, Mr. Oswald.